Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Woman's Splain. Today, we have a very special guest, Ray Bebock. She is the founder and CEO of Hooray Girl Beer, really innovative beer company for women. I'm going to pass over to her, kind of give a little intro, and then talk about her story.
Thanks for coming.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm Ray, founder of Hooray's Girl Beer. We are a flavored light beer brand that's kind of flipping the script and the narrative around the beer category at a super high level. There's obviously a lot more into it, but that's the quick gist.
I love that. So tell me more. What does it, would love to just hear a little bit about your background. I know you've had a kind of a long winding career journey. You went to college, you started in banking, you kind of transitioned out of that, and then also were inspired to start this beer company. So let's kind of start at the beginning.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. So I went to NYU undergrad. I was in Stern.
Okay.
So
we understand we're in Wharton.
So you're like,
we're with you, girl. Finance. All the finance clubs, we're here. Okay.
So it was really interesting. You know, I'm from Vermont originally. Okay. So when I got to NYU, I was like, this is crazy. I literally lived in the woods my entire life. So then, you know, get to New York trying to figure out my path. But I was in Stern. And so you sort of have this like,
algorithm. Built without path for you.
There's a path that's there. But I felt a little lost at first. I, you know, majored in finance, but I minored in art history. I honestly thought I was going to go into art business.
Very cool. So
I like interned at Christie's and was really into the sort of art world, but realized there was literally no viable path of making any money in the near term. Like I would talk to my bosses when I was interning, like, how much are you making? And they're like, you don't want to know. And like, I'm eating peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for dinner and lunch every day.
You're like,
I was
noted.
Like, yeah, noted. That's tough. So didn't feel very viable, but I kind of loved how like interesting and creative that could be. But again, this path was sort of laid out for me at Stern. And so ended up studying finance and really like leaning into it in undergrad. After school, went to join the healthcare group at JP Morgan. So I was doing investment banking and lasted a year to the day.
Hey, I mean, better than a lot of people.
Anything
hey,
over a year or a year
that
plus.
That means you survived. It means you
it's
survived.
Hard.
You're there.
A year to the day.
Just and, like rotting in a cubicle.
Literally. Yeah. And like, it's interesting, not to toot my own horn, but like, I was a top bucket analyst. Like, I was doing well. There's just something that felt missing from the day to day.
Like a soul.
A soul could be one.
Happiness.
Light,
vitamin D.
Yeah. I mean, really, what put it over the edge? You guys will love this. So I was in the healthcare group going. We did a lot of biotech deals. I was like doing a lot of pharma biotech. And we had this big IPO that we were working on, flying to Boston because, you know, there are a lot of biotech companies there. And I had all the books, right? And first flight's delayed, second flight's delayed, like canceled, whatever. My associates text me like, when are you getting here? And then upon takeoff, we hit a bird and blew out an engine.
Oh my God. And it's so, like the Sully fucking flight. It's like the Sully flight.
Literally.
I didn't even know that was happening.
And so I'm sitting next to the engine. There's like a random lawyer who's sitting next to me who's also going to for another biotech dealer or whatever. We're like holding hands. The engine's like, the engine like smells like,
you're like,
burning.
I can't die like this.
I'm texting my associate being like, look, I have the books, but my pay might go down.
He's like, I might need that. Walk about here.
Yeah, he's like, I don't care. Yeah. Ship it to me.
Yeah, and I think that was like what put it over the edge. I was like,
that'll
okay, like this is not okay. The life that I want to live. Yeah,
fair enough.
I understand.
And so then I left, and then you know, had the great idea of going to work at WeWork.
Which was super hot at the time, to be fair. Like, let's remind us how hot WeWork was in, like, 2018, right?
It was
like,
a roller coaster.
It was, like, the hottest place to work, right?
Sure.
It was on fire. They had great culture. Everyone's, like,
we had, like, summer camp every year.
Summer camp. I mean, I knew I had so many friends who worked at WeWork, and it was, like, a super hot job.
Really, really interesting. And we knew that, you know, it could go in any direction. It was definitely a controversial company in some ways, at least in terms of how they were operating. And I thought it'd be, you know, it was effectively Adam Neumann's chief of staff team. And so,
I mean, great at that time, great opportunity.
For like 23, amazing. And I wanted to go into the corporate world. And so, you know, was there, got a lot of great experiences, learned, I think, more than anything, how not to run a company. which is just as beneficial. Mm-hmm. And, you know, was helping with the initial IPO process that kind of imploded. And things started imploding at the company. It was clear that, you know, this was a rocky boat. And I wanted to go and do something else. And sort of around that time, COVID hit. I was living in Brooklyn and, you know, wanted to press the reset button, which is a silver lining, obviously an incredibly difficult time. And I'm from Vermont originally. I went back to my family's cabin in Vermont and was like living on Lake Champlain, figuring out what I wanted to do next. And I told my dad, I was like, I want to go ski bum in Jackson and build mountain bike trails. And my dad goes, like, you've never held a shovel in your life. So I don't know if that's going to work. And I was like, valid. There's like a small startup ecosystem in Vermont that,
really?
Yeah,
oh,
like Seventh Generation started there.
Green Mountain Coffee,
Ben and Jerry's. And so I was just hitting up some founders being like, here's my resume. I'm around. Like, there's no chance in hell I'm going to live here. But, you know, here to help if you need anything. And the founders of a small alcohol brand got back to me and they were like, yeah, come in and label some bottles. And I was like, you know, I've lived in a corporate cubicle for the last, you know, 4 years of my life. I sure. Literally
why
anything
not?
Else.
Yeah.
And so walked into this empty warehouse. They were vertically integrating at the time and labeled some bottles and got chatting with the founders. They quickly realized I could help them with other things. And like labeling bottles quite literally turned into me helping run the day-to-day operations of the company. So I was buying equipment, buying cans, which was also crazy because there was like a massive can shortage at the time. So I was like,
everyone was drinking during COVID.
Everyone's drinking. There was also like aluminum shortages and all like just whole supply chain mess. So I was like sourcing cans from like weird dudes in Mexico, like crazy stuff, helping them with fundraising, you know, hiring. It was really a 2-year crash course into beverage and running a beverage company. And it was really while I was there that I started to see how male dominated the industry is. And that's someone coming from finance, right? I was shocked.
And this was a beer company, like craft beer?
They were making cider and like a light wine at the time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
So kind of trying to be this like beverage incubator company, very Northeast focused. But still, you know, I think I was one of 2 female full-time employees. And we were making products that were marketed to women, right?
That's fascinating.
And so I think a combination of that and, you know, helping with some of the investor decks and looking at the data was just like honestly pretty astounded. You know, I came across some stats like 30% of beer drinkers are female, but the majority of consumer spend, nearly 80% of consumer spend, is expected to be controlled or influenced by women over the next couple of decades,
yeah.
Right? So clearly a disconnect. Like there wasn't parity within beer demographics. And my thesis was that that's kind of a social construct. It's not necessarily anything to do with the product, because the product inherently itself could have a lot of the attributes that, you know, I think that my friends would want out of a drink out. Mm-hmm. And so there's clearly a disconnect. And I looked at who was running these beer companies, and it was clear that it was a bunch of fucking old white men.
Yeah, who haven't also innovated at all, which is fascinating. Like, you think, honestly, I also say the beer monopoly and, like, duopoly basically exists of, like, Anheuser-Busch pretty much.
100%.
And, like, that's basically all, and they have not changed since, like, 1954.
And when they try to change, it blows up in their face.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I remember, like, the whole,
like the Travis Scott thing,
and then there was the really disastrous thing with, like, the
Dylan Mulvaney. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You can't, like, they have their core consumer. And that core consumer is super loyal. And
they're also going to die.
They're also going to die.
Like, literally, factually. they are not being replaced by a younger demographic right now.
1,000%.
And they will, are honestly, probably have the lowest life expectancy of any group. So
1,000%. Yeah. The industry is at a juncture, a critical juncture, and you're kind of seeing it with growth rates now. You know, they've slowed. And really struggled to find this new demographic. But, like, I think only 2% of beer companies are majority owned by women.
That is crazy.
And so it's not, like, it's surprising, but not that surprising. I think consumers are smart and they see the marketing gaslighting that happens. And you can say a product is for women all you want, but like, is it really for women if it's made by a bunch of dudes in a boardroom?
Who think they know what women want. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or like think like this data is going to actually give them like real glean into what's missing.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And I think the other observation that I had before starting the company, and this is kind of more broadly in the consumer space, is how women are marketed to. I think, typically when you think of like a girl brand, it's focusing on aesthetics and kind of this like
wellness,
cute packaging, wellness, health. And these are things that a lot of women want, and no shame on that. But I think there's also room to capture like the messiness and unfiltered nature of girlhood that and womanhood that's like not necessarily captured in a lot of consumer brands. And it's super interesting. I think it was only in like 1974 that women could actually get credit on their own.
Yeah.
Crazy, right?
Yeah, we have an illegal abortion first, so you get our own checking account.
So this is really like the first, you know, couple of generations that have been financially independent truly from marriage. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as a result, having kids later, getting married later, shifting priorities. And so there's more room for play and fun. And there aren't a lot of humor-focused girl brands. And so we kind of wanted to tackle that head on and put both of these observations together and create this like really diabolical liquid death type marketing, satirical, weird thing into the world.
Awesome. So you're working at this beer company and you see this disconnect.
Yeah.
Then what happens? How do you start?
Oh my gosh. Well, I was like backcountry skiing one day and it kind of like dawned upon me that all of this, like it was like a very like aha moment. I think that was in 2021 though. So it was very early on when I was even working there. So that's when it was kind of in the back of my head. And during that time, I was putting out surveys to my friends. I was asking my friends about what their relationship to beer was. I was getting as much industry research as possible and really ruminating. And that rumination happened for like a couple of years, honestly. I ended up working remotely for the company and I moved to the Bay, kind of knowing that I wanted to launch this company. And California is just an awesome place to start a beverage company, especially in alcohol, for a lot of different reasons. So sort of angling myself out eventually and gathering information. And I ended up leaving my job, knowing that in order to really like focus on it, you should be able to devote more time. I also wanted a bit of a break. I'd been in corporate America for so long. So I took something like, I don't know, 6-8 months just to take some time off. There was also, we traumatically like lost two friends during that period of time. So I was just like, I need a break, like need time off. And really gave myself a lot of space, still had this kind of idea in the back of my head, was working on it, you know, over that period of time, thinking about what the product would really look like, started blind tasting my friends on just drinks that were already out in the market, seeing what they liked without branding, started to think about the brand identity and the positioning that I wanted. During that time, actually, at the side hustle of working for Wall Street Prep.
Honestly, wow. It's like, what a good side hustle. You can make money doing that shit.
Yeah, it's
easy.
Incredible. Yeah. Highly recommend. They're an awesome company. There are a lot of entrepreneurs who do it.
Yeah.
It's like part-time. You can do it on the side. And then slowly built the company, right? Like started reaching out to formulators and brewers and designers and, doing larger focus groups, doing pilot runs, sort of snowballed from there. It was a long journey, I will say, and I think there is this pressure in consumer to just start and just go and just figure it out and do it. But I do think, especially for something that leans so heavily into creative, there's a beauty in that rumination and that space to think about what this really looks like in the world.
What are some like early insights that you found while you were talking to friends and family and doing like the early stage type of customer interviews that really influenced how you did the R&D and like launched a product?
A lot of the, so from like a brand, like beer had a branding problem. Beer had a branding problem for sure. It was, you know, very largely stigmatized as bro-y and fratty. Which is odd because that doesn't necessarily exist in other places in the world.
Yeah.
So that was one, you know, more so validating my thesis. From a product perspective, it was very clear that there was an opportunity to both bring in a net new beer consumer while still creating a product that beer consumers would love by leaning into the flavored light beer category, which was something that really hasn't been so significantly built out. There are some companies that might have like one-off SKUs, but not a brand focusing on this space. And that's really what the big opportunity is. It's bringing in a new consumer that the big beer companies have failed to do so, and really introducing that consumer to the category. That was the biggest piece of insight. And so from that, started doing tons and tons of pilot runs, you know, testing different flavor combinations. Ended up working with a brewer who is just like an industry vet, and getting the product to where it is today.
That's amazing. And kind of going off of that, I mean, how do you differentiate yourself from like seltzers as well? I know it's not a beer, but I feel like seltzer has been like the industry's attempt to bring women into beer. Yeah. It's not beer, but it is marketed to women.
Yeah.
It's low calorie. It's flavored. I mean, I personally love them. How do you people tend to compare you to that? And how do you kind of differentiate from that?
It can be, and it has been in some ways, but not at least I think more in terms of the intent than the flavor profile. I think there are a lot of similar properties. I think the difference in our value prop versus a seltzer is that, you know, I mean, I know you love seltzer, but the reality is it's like fermented sugar syrup.
Yeah,
it's terrible. Yeah. No, hey, no, you can offend. Like, please, yeah, offend me.
And so, like, the beauty of beer is that it's a natural product.
Yeah.
And, you know, it is literally of the earth. Yeah, it doesn't have that sort of like artificial taste. And my thesis on any sort of beverage and honestly, most alcohol trends is all of this is so cyclical. So you have to go where others aren't. People are going to get fatigued from products. And we're sort of seeing that in seltzer where growth is really plateaued.
Totally.
You know, you have the brands that are winning and that's sort of it. It'd be really hard to launch a seltzer brand today.
Yeah, way too saturated.
So you got to look where others aren't. And at the time when I launched and when we were, you know, first concepting the brand, no one was looking at the category. They're like, you know, this is, you have your craft beer brands and that's kind of it. And they weren't looking at it as a solution. And so if you're able to go where others aren't, you have more opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think like your kind of finance corporate training helped you think differently than most alcohol entrepreneurs? Because
so interesting.
Yeah, a lot of alcohol entrepreneurs, I think, are very passion driven.
Yeah.
Typically sales background.
Yeah.
And, you know, from a like general stereotype, kind of like partiers that want to like kind of continue that. Right. And like start something that's more like fun and they like. But I feel like you really thought about this very strategically. And what do you think drove that?
Yeah, I think there's a ton of benefit. I think there are, I will also say, some detriments to being in the corporate world that I think are worth observing and questioning. If you're out there in it, right?
Yeah.
So I would say the pro was, you know, obviously hyper analytical. And if you can think globally and take those sort of like insights via data and translate it into a brand, you have an incredible advantage. Because all of this is very, you have to be objective about the decisions you're making. Like it's in order to de-risk and to not have this just be a brand based on luck and hope, right?
Mm-hmm.
The second thing that's really positive is I think it makes you a incredibly diligent operator. You have that corporate training. You understand how a P&L works. You understand the story behind a P&L. It helps with investor conversations, knowing exactly how to position the company, how to operate the company, right? So there are a lot of benefits. You can create that rigor very early on, which is critical for such a tight margin business. I'd say the detriment of the corporate world broadly, and this is banking and consulting or even going to undergraduate business school, is that there can be a herd mentality.
Yeah.
I think we've all experienced that. And I see so many people who have this would be unbelievable entrepreneurs, and I think get caught in the, what bracket am I in? What bonus am I making? Where am I standing versus everyone else? What's my path to being, an associate in 2 years? What's my path to becoming, a partner? All of this stuff that just muddies and weighs on you and kind of deteriorates the creative space needed to start a company. And so that's, I would encourage everyone to really think about that critically.
Yeah, I think it's super tough because you're working, in high school to get into a college, and you're working in college to get a good job, and you do, banking, PE, whatever. So I think it's really good that you broke out of that mold. Do you think
it's hard?
It's hard.
It's hard. Really, it's hard. Your peers. It's
fucking scary.
Yeah,
it's really scary. And you're young.
And a lot
doing
of people
it.
Don't take that leap, and rightfully so, because you're have such a cushy job, so stable. And why would you take that chance?
Yeah.
Do you think if you hadn't worked at WeWork and COVID happened, I think it all really happened naturally for you, that you would be an entrepreneur today? Would you have founded Hooray's Girl Beer? Or did you already always have that entrepreneurial type of spirit? Or do you think it was more the timing and hating the job?
I think honestly, when I was a kid, I was always pretty creative. I was always making things and building things and painting and doing weird stuff. And I have a theory that we always kind of, as we age, we kind of go back to who we were children, most purely in some ways. We find those aspects of ourselves. And I'd clearly built this skill set that was very specific from finance, from business, and wanted to, tap back into that side of me that I think I had lost in my early 20s, mid-20s, even in college to some degree. And this felt like the best path to do that, where, you could really put something net new and different into the world. It was really a creative pursuit in a lot of ways. And so I think the cards and the dominoes kind of fell that way. But it's hard to say, I think with the path that I was on, with my personality, I can't imagine doing anything else, yeah. Honestly.
I feel like knowing you, I can't imagine that you did this for so long. I can't imagine that you were a JPM investment banker. not knowing you that long, but I'm you have such a really I don't know, just lovely energy that does not feel
bubbly
corporate.
It
feels very
creative.
It feels like the art side of you. I can kind of see the fact that you're from Vermont. I get that.
I was such a hardo also. I was I'm going to be the CEO of JP Morgan.
Stop.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Oh, my God.
It was crazy. And I'm it's crazy. And
when you're in that environment, that's kind of how they groom you. Yeah.
It does. It does. And if you are, it's such a crazy thing.
And if you're a competitive person, which I feel like all entrepreneurs are, you're gonna it will bring out that side. You will just fucking compete. That's what it's built to do. Right?
Yeah. It's what it's built
to do. It's built to just make you the most competitive person alive. And it's effective.
Yeah. For sure. And I think it's only becoming kind of back to this path piece and the path that's laid out. It's only becoming more and more challenging to question that path, which is unfortunate. Again, with teaching finance to a lot of these analyst classes and even colleges and diversity programs, these kids are getting recruited sophomore year. How are you supposed to know?
Yeah.
Earlier now, you're literally 18.
How are you even supposed to, college is supposed to be for exploration. Mm-hmm. You're not supposed to know who you are at 18 or 20 or 22.
Yeah.
If you are then forced into this very lucrative, very attractive, why would you ever do anything? Why would you ever spend any time thinking about what you want when, like, it's a lot easier, especially at that age, to just do what other people mm-hmm. want you to do. It's a lot fucking easier and rewarding. Like, you know, it's like, why?
And it's what's socially accepted.
Exactly.
Because, right? Like, I'm sure this happened at Warren. If you didn't have a job by the end, like, of college, yeah. it's like, what's wrong with
you? Like, what are you?
It's horrible.
It's horrible.
It's horrible. It makes no sense. So, yeah. I don't know. It's, I hope the next generations question it more and kind of push back on it. I think it's the only way to change that system. But it's like,
I agree.
I mean, we see a lot more.
This podcast. Yeah. I mean, yeah. And I mean, I was certainly part of that for sure. It's terrifying. And I also think women, too, are not encouraged at the same level to explore, to challenge, to take risks. You know, speaking of the fact that we are like the first generation of financially independent women, I think we're also fucking terrified to not be financially stable.
Yeah.
As well. Just because I think a lot of us have seen generations of women stuck without financial independence. Yeah. And, like, that is a really scary prospect. So it's like, that is also a whole thing we need to fight against as well.
1,000%.
Yeah.
And speaking of, I do love your marketing. Just going back to your company, yes. I do. I mean, looking through it, I love this idea because it really is a very unique marketing prop that brings a lot of joy to women. And I do, it just feels really funny and fun and hilarious. And like
defiant, like, yeah. I'm my own person, like, fuck the system.
It's like meant to be like what we're all thinking, but just not saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's so much marketing gaslighting that's just like ridiculous. The whole corporate like jargon and what a brand is supposed to do and how it's supposed to act. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of room to create brands that are characters that really speak to people, but are also these objects and things in the world that consumers can impose their own imagination on. And when you think about art, and it's like going back to my like art history background and the piece of art that I love the most, there are always pieces that might mean something to me if it's something different to someone else. And when you give that like flexibility and room, you can create something really cool and speak to a lot of people in different ways.
Yeah. And how has it been like being a first-time founder? You're doing everything from marketing, R&D, social media,
yeah.
manufacturing, like contracts. Like, how has that been and how did you learn how to do that?
Oh my gosh. I mean, you learn by doing, I guess, and being kind of just like, you know, forced into it. Like, you force yourself into it and then you just do it. You just learn on the go. I think, again, having the background I did gave me a foundation, both in beverage and in finance. It, you know, I had a set of contacts to start off with and, you know, to get the ball rolling and figure out what I need to do first. But it's hard. I feel like every founder says this. And whenever they said it to me when I was first starting, I kind of glazed over. It is far harder than I ever imagined. I think the level of responsibility that I feel to my team is something that I've, you know, never felt before, you know, like I don't have kids, you know, yeah. I don't have any like thing or being that is like mm-hmm. reliant on me. And it's not to say that my team is like fully reliant on me, but this is their livelihood. I pay their salaries. And there's this level of like responsibility that
they took a risk on you. You're a startup. You probably feel that as well.
Totally.
Yeah,
totally.
And I mean, I obviously love the concept, love that. Are you a beer drinker yourself? Were you before? Did you feel that as well when you were kind of building this?
I mean, part of the reason I made this product was it was a product I wanted.
Yeah.
Like if I had a beer, I was drinking like Corona Light.
Totally.
Just like pee water. I know. Gross. It's pee water. But it's like,
good. Hey,
it's
I
like
have it on
drinkable,
the beach.
Easy.
Yeah, like, right.
Drinkable, easy. But I was looking for something with more flavor,
yeah.
ideally. So yeah, I drink beer. And Vermont is actually, we have the highest number of breweries per capita.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. There's a ton of craft beers from Vermont.
Okay.
So I was just always sort of surrounded by that world, and maybe by osmosis was like, let's do it.
Yeah.
I don't know.
That's awesome.
Something that I've been thinking about a lot, I love food and beverage, love alcohol, you know, love a good drink. But I know there's a lot of health concerns nowadays. There was that article from the health department saying that is as cancer, is as tobacco. And that's really hard for someone who loves, you know, drinks like me. And of course, like brands like yours. So how do you kind of deal with that moving forward? And how do you balance, I guess, the health and wellness aspect of your brand?
Yeah, I mean, I think broadly speaking, it's really, I think, dangerous for any alcohol brand to position themselves as a health and wellness brand. There are a lot that do it, right? Yeah. There are a lot that do it. Like, yeah. Call a spade a spade. It is alcohol. Yeah. I think that there are, you know, with moderation and kind of the right balance, benefits to imbibing and like enjoying a drink with your friends. It's community. It's bringing people together. But in moderation, and like, it's in part why we're a lighter beverage. Like, same with me. These are, you know, concerns that I have about my own alcohol consumption. And I've cut like heavy liquor out almost entirely, right? Like, I prefer lighter drinks. I like imbibing. I like hanging out with my friends. Mm. I like, you know, enjoying and participating in that social ritual in moderation.
Yeah.
And so I think it's making sure we message in that way where it's, you know, this is a moderate drink and it's positioned as such for that, but there are risks. Yeah. There are risks.
Do you think you'll ever kind of explore like NA, like mocktail world at all?
No. Yeah. Honestly, no.
Yeah.
I think that I have very strong views about the NA category as a whole. I think that the biggest replacement of alcohol in the NA category is soda. Yeah. By and large. And so I think that's perhaps one of the more interesting categories for me is like replacements of alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
NA, I think that a lot of, at least within beer, the data is a bit overanalyzed. You're starting to see, you know, you obviously have Athletic that has popped off and done incredibly well. Yeah. And I'm very close to the founder. He's amazing. I'm so impressed with what he's built. Tastes That's like great. Beer. It's incredible. Incredibly run business. Like, I'm so impressed with what they've done. They've effectively cornered the market in most ways outside of the big beer players. And there is this tendency in consumer to like post a bunch of data online and hold it all to be truth, or, you know, it just kind of gets overblown in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
When you actually look at sobriety rates over the last decade, they've been relatively stagnant. So my thesis is we aren't like next generation, you know, drinking age Gen Z, millennials, they're not necessarily imbibing and like drinking in the way that our parents did, right? Like, my parents have like a glass of wine every night, not necessarily doing that. So the category is not necessarily as, you know, massive from the like how much an individual is drinking on a weekly basis. But people are moderating.
Yeah.
And you can moderate in different ways. And so that's my thesis on it. Probably no NA. It's, at least I don't have like plans to. But it's also important. We're so early and I'm like hyper keyed on focus right now. Yeah.
And I mean, the other edge to that is that people are moving away from hard alcohol. They're moving towards something with a lower percentage of alcohol that is slightly healthier for them. That's also like more sippable and more sustainable. Right. So actually, 100%. There's absolutely an argument to say that like beer will become more popular.
Yeah.
Lower things with lower alcohol content will become more popular and they're a lot healthier for you over time. Yeah. Right. And there's also, I mean, the whole like, obviously no one thinks alcohol is great for you, but there also is like, I mean, blue zones and like life, like the people who tend to live longer in these blue zones also are drink in moderation. So there's also like an argument to say that alcohol like decreases stress,
right?
And actually increases your life expectancy. Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's kind of muddied. And I actually think you like this sober, curious, like idea could also be curbed with lower alcohol content.
Mm-hmm. Moderation.
Yeah.
Moderation is the key word. I agree. And like, generally, alcohol has been a part of human history forever.
It'd
be a really, really big assumption to say that it will be completely gone, but I think it will change, and I think people are being conscious of the ways they consume.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Yeah.
Do you see Hooray Girl Beer as more any potential in restaurants, in bars? Do you see it becoming part of cocktails? Like, what do you kind of see, or would you like it to kind of stay retail?
We're in some bars right now too in LA. So yeah, we're in Whole Foods, BevMo, in LA. Just launched Total Wine.
Congrats.
So it's exciting.
BevMo is like my childhood place. I mean, I grew up in California, so it's like literally such a California thing.
It's crazy.
I have a lot of memories of just shoplifting from BevMo. Oh, like literally. So at age like like 15.
It's such a funny spot.
It's like, yeah, I feel like I think the BevMo parking lot was the meeting place in high school.
Oh my gosh.
If Randy from BevMo is seeing this, I'm so sorry.
we're lying.
I'm sorry. Yeah, for sure. Some real shit went down in the BevMo parking lot.
So funny. But there's some like great, like you can go and explore it out.
BevMo is great. I'm so sad it's only in California.
Yeah, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Like, it's such a California. It's literally Costco for alcohol. It's 100% just all alcohol. And
awesome.
The reason why California, because the liquor laws are so lax there. Right?
Yeah. Exactly. So they have like, they did a partnership with GoPuff, so they do delivery and all that. But yeah, we're in some like key bars. We've really focused on a couple of neighborhoods in LA specifically. LA is so massive, and our core audience lives in, you know, a handful of neighborhoods for the most part. Go out in a handful of neighborhoods. So we've taken this approach of doubling down on independent accounts in those neighborhoods to like really generate some buzz. So it's like Silver Lake, Santa Monica, Venice, you know, over kind of by like downtown USC campus area, right? So we're all over the place. I think we're almost in 100 doors, which is crazy.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
In five months. Oh my gosh. What's been like the process of getting into those major retailers like Whole Foods? I feel like that's incredibly difficult.
Yeah. It's incredible. And I would also say, I think there is at least I got this advice a lot from people, was to not go into chain retail at the beginning.
Really?
And I think it's a misunderstanding. First of all, at least in this, funding environment, how difficult it is to even raise a single dollar. Every single dollar of burn that you have should be going to the best piece of data that you can make. And if you were somehow able to get really quality data, velocity data from key chain retailers that mean something to investors, and it's where consumers shop, then you should go for it out the gate if you can. But what you can do is negotiate with the buyers and say, no, I don't want the full footprint of LA. I want 10 doors. Launch us into those 10 doors. Let me show you how we do, and then let's go from there. And you're not going to like shoot yourself in the foot by doing that. Frankly, the buyers are going to appreciate that. So the process was long. It was like an 8-month long, you know, initial introduction to both BevMo and Whole Foods. You know, they were interested. Kind of warm intros at that point, slowly talk to them over time, and, you know, with time convince them to, you know, be launch partners with them. But again, that key piece is limit the footprint, because you can overextend yourself so quickly, but there's a benefit. You'd rather be in 10 Whole Foods than 10 bodegas, in my opinion, especially for a beverage product where it's scale is so critical that you need an outlet to quickly scale.
Yeah. So you launched 5 months ago.
Yeah.
I'm sure you had like the R&D all good before you launch. You're focusing on distribution. What's next that you're working on right now?
More points of retail. We have a couple of very large chain retailers that are likely coming in the fall, which is really exciting. And then another very large media partnership that would be sick if we can land it. So we'll see. But really looking to expand in Southern, like at a high level, looking to expand in Southern California, continue to connect with our audience there, continue to build the brand and the brand story, you know, building out really like the goal is to build out the infrastructure over the next like 6 to 9 months for scale. Because right now, you know, it's me. I have, you know, a team of effectively like a couple of employees and a bunch of contractors that we work with, and want to make sure we have the ability to like to scale. Going to San Diego will be our next market, and then expand to Northern California and Arizona, I'd hope by the end of the next 12 months.
And maybe New York.
Honestly, no.
Really?
Because the liquor laws are so strict.
Well, it's in part, the drinking habits here are so
excessive.
Different.
It's on premise. It's bars. It's restaurants. And it's hard with a canned product. You do really well if you're like a liquor company. But it's a hard market to win. And for us, I think big box retail, big chain grocery is like our way to go, mass market. And so I want to go like win the Southeast. I want to go win
Florida.
Florida, well,
it feels like
Arizona.
A beach drink. Yeah. It feels like a tropical drink. It does, yeah. Right? I mean, I don't know. I mean, that's how it feels.
Yeah.
Like you feel like you buy and go to the beach with your friends.
Yeah, like
you
buy a pack.
You do the summer here, to the Hamptons or something. But
and I think it's important to figure out whether or not you can get mass market appeal early. Yeah. So many brands are started in New York and LA that like you're in a bit of a bubble. And so just because, you know, it crushes the Erewhon doesn't mean it's going to crush in like Arkansas.
Totally.
And so when we were building this brand, it was always with that in mind, like, okay, what would like the Silver Lake girly like, and like, is it something that some, you know, girly pop in Alabama is about too, and like get those kind of spectrum of experiences and and
make I feel it like the sorority girls in Alabama are all love this
oh
shit.
They would love it,
right? I don't know, that's a good, I don't know, it's a good market.
I think so.
Rush
it's
talk.
A good market. Rush talk.
21 plus.
21 plus.
Don't follow my footsteps. Yeah.
So have you raised at all?
Yes. We've raised like effectively, I don't even know how to call any of these rounds anymore, like pre-seed round.
Yep.
Yeah.
Predominantly from angels and one fund.
Spice Capital, that's how I got introduced. Right.
Maya.
She's great.
Yeah,
she's
shout awesome. Out Maya.
Yeah.
You guys should definitely talk to her. I think she'd be great on this. She's like a cool person.
She's really cool.
Yeah. But yeah, you know, I think got lucky in a lot of ways. It's really hard to raise. It's really hard to raise. And those are relationships that were built up over over a decade, a lot of them.
Yeah.
So it's
No, it's hard. I mean, it's a big reason we started this. I mean, as I was an investor for 5 years and, you know, was in the early stage growth space for that long. And I just think, one, the type of person that becomes an investor comes from a very similar background. And I think if we talked about all kind of these problems with, you're just trained in a certain way, which like honestly is successful, but disallows for openness in terms of investing. And it's very hard. And I think
especially at this stage, because it's biased.
And consumer already kind of has a strike against it.
Yeah.
So then you kind of walk in with a consumer product for women and like, they're like, no.
I think people invest in
what they like, what they feel like they would drink, what they feel like they would like, right? And it's
and
you know,
seeing themselves in the founder.
Yes.
Yeah.
100%.
And all these investors are men.
Don't look like me.
Yeah. I mean, and like to connect to that and to understand like the female experience, understand not be also there is so much about your product that's like this hole in the market that people are being forgotten, right?
Yeah.
And the investor crowd is not being forgotten by the market. I can promise you that. So I feel like it's like this target that's not really being seen. So yeah, we want to be able to highlight that. Like there's so much success that's being overlooked. And, you know, these ideas are also being overtaken and sort of, you know,
agreed.
Whatever.
Agreed.
So more women need to become investors.
I know, for real.
Well.
And I will say like the female investors in my life have been incredible advocates.
Yeah.
And you need that early. You need people who are like, you know, they are more like the people I'm thinking about are more like seed, Series A investors and investors that I've, you know, developed relationships with for now the last couple of years. But they encouraged me early. And like those are it's so rare to see from investors. Again, even though they weren't investing in my pre-seed round because it was too early. You know, they made sure they connected me with everyone that they could. They were like, keep going, keep pushing, keep doing it. You need those little, you can do it very early or else, you know, I see so many people quit. I see so many founders quit before they launch a product because it's so deterring. It's so hard. So you get so many no's. But now that, you know, I've launched and I'm 5-6 months into this company in market, no's become yeses very quickly, very quickly. And I think it's something I wish I had known when I started, because when you're getting a lot of no's, you have it, I don't know, like at least someone like me who is like, you know, worked in finance and like, I'm just going to will this to an answer and I'm going to like make this work. You're like pushing a boulder up a hill. And it's almost better to be like, okay, it's a no for now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like instead of willing it to happen, how do you think you like fought through all of these problems that came up early? I mean, especially CPG, I mean, manufacturing of beer. I can't even imagine the complications, fathom how difficult that was to create. Like how, what did you do to really kind of fight through these just deep moments of therapy. Discouragement.
Like, literally, shout out Jenny.
Yeah.
Jenny, help me. But also a really great advisory board.
Okay.
I think that having equity advisors early is like, they're effectively mentors with skin in the game.
Yeah.
Who are there helping you functionally operate or, you know, sell or whatever it might be. And so that was one piece of like getting industry people behind me who are like in it with me. Really, really helpful. I think, you know, Maya, our investor, she is I've known her since I was 18, and, you know, I saw her build Spice, and it's obviously an incredibly difficult thing to start your own fund, especially as a solo female, you know, woman of color.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. And so Maya has been just the biggest advocate. And like, I probably wouldn't have started this without her, honestly. Yeah.
And I'm sure like other founders in consumer that are female, is there a big community of consumer founders in LA?
Yeah, for sure. We have like a little crew that hangs out. It's actually really nice. A little group chat. LA is a great place to start a brand. There are a lot of founders, which is cool. Yeah, for sure. You know, female founder groups. You know, I had moved from the Bay to LA to launch the brand here, and I had a little crew in San Francisco as well that I would meet with like weekly on Fridays just to like get coffee and cry together. So that was definitely very helpful. And then I'd say having you know, just industry mentors as well. You know, like Bill Schufelt from Athletic. He has connections to Vermont, and you know, it's just been like an awesome advocate for me and a great person to run things by, and a really like North Star of how to operate a business and like operate it ethically, being like a good human and leader. And he takes a lot of time out of his day to like help new founders, and it's just super admirable. So, you know, folks like him that really just like kept me going and like believing in myself when no one else did. It's just hard.
Yeah, especially being a solo founder too, right? Yeah. I mean, that must be really tough for you as well. I feel like that's a really unique journey. I mean, how do you think you've been able to handle that too?
Oh man, there is some, you know, deep bouts of loneliness sometimes. I think it's gotten better as I've like started, and it's always, I think getting through it is always like, okay, there's going to be a light at the end of the tunnel because I'm going to like make a plan. I'm going to hire this person and that person and hire a contractor to fill this thing in. Like, they're definitely, I think, at least from the purely like operating it and just the sheer hours of working, like creating little glimmers of hope by like hiring and having a plan and like these are the things I'm gonna do. From like an emotional standpoint, it's incredibly difficult. And I think but again, like Maya has been so involved with the company that it's almost like she's been a co-founder. I mean, obviously she's not day to day, but is always a sounding board. And honestly, like sometimes I'm just like blowing up her phone. I'm like, this is going wrong and that's going wrong. And I'm like, and she's like, dude, it's good. Like, you're good. And that's all you kind of need to hear is someone who's gone through similar experiences, understands, and just kind of like echoes what you're saying. But it's not a glorious path. It's not a glorious path. I think there's a lot of, like putting founders on a pedestal, and it is like, I feel the least hot that I've ever felt. You know what
you
I mean?
You look great.
You look beautiful. You look
I'm
great.
I'm tired.
Yeah, you're tired.
I'm tired.
I love that you have a great relationship with your investor. I think that's also like, that's something I've noticed in the industry. I think like operator investor relationships can be really tough. Right.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of like, you know, founders don't want to share with their investors, which is totally fair. And they're very scared. So, I mean, do you think it was just from Maya just really just like open that trust, or like, how do you think that
Maya is
that?
A special investor. Maya is a special person, and like all of her founders feel this way too.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She is someone who wants to problem solve.
Yeah.
Because it can be really scary. And I think it's the other sort of like thing about the industry that I've observed and has been surprising to me is like how full of shit everyone is, but in part because of these pressures. Yeah. And, you know, I think there's a really interesting piece. Paul Vogue, he's a started Ouroboro, which is like a sparkling water company he just sold. And he put out like a very candid piece about that sale. And, you know, I think he's probably stoked that they sold and it's like, you know, but maybe not like the best outcome that he was expecting. And having founders like that just be like, this is the truth, we need to see more of. And yeah, it's hard, but it is hard. It's hard because you have these pressures. You have the pressures of retailers, you have the pressures of perception and all of these things, but we could all benefit from some more candidness and transparency and be less like insane.
Yeah. No, for sure. I mean, I think it's just so complicated. A lot of times like founders and investors just are completely different as well. What they're doing every day is completely different. They both are experiencing extraordinarily high pressure.
Yeah.
And they're both fucking scared, right? And so sometimes it's just like, how do you even foster that trust? How do you make this communication helpful?
Yeah.
Sometimes less information is better.
Yeah.
It just really depends. And I think it's a really hard thing.
But it's the importance of having investors on your cap table who are great, especially in early stages. And I think it's why getting angel investors who get it are you know, really helpful. Like Bobby Bitten from O Positive is one of our investors, which is like a women's supplement company. And he's just like, I'm just like, dude, like, shit's blown up. And he's like, you know, he's someone I can just go talk to very candidly about it.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, there are like a few examples of that on my cap table, which is really helpful. But I'm lucky. I've gotten lucky with how things have turned out with my cap table right now. I'm sure it'll change with time, right? And so, but yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. Well, yeah. I think that's amazing to hear. This I think that's a good reminder. Yeah,
it's been such a good conversation. Thank you so much for sharing your journey and making the time. I know you're based in LA, so we're so happy to have you here in New York. Before we end, we always ask our founders one piece of advice that you would give to, you know, a young female or male looking to start a company.
It kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier, but most of this is just smoke and mirrors. Like, most of this is just like a bunch of shit. I have no idea what's describing it. Genuinely. Yeah. I think that the things that you see on LinkedIn, the things that you see on these podcasts, the things that you hear, the things that your friends are saying, or this founder saying, or this investor saying, it's not necessarily always the truth and like the full picture. I think that's really important to remember because sometimes it can be deterring to people. They're like, I haven't met these milestones and this person did this. And it's like, well, yeah, that person did that because, like, you know, their dad does X, Y, and Z, or their mom does X, Y, and Z, or, you know, whatever it might be. And there's just always more to the picture than what meets the eye. And I think that's important to remember. It's just the truth isn't always out there.
We love that. Awesome. Well, awesome. Where can we find you? Obviously, you're in BevMo. You are in Whole Foods.
Total Wine. Social media. LA, you can buy a plane ticket. Go to Los Angeles.
We will be out there.
Are you in e-commerce at all? Are you thinking about e-commerce?
We will eventually, yeah. Okay, we're sort of like in the middle of creating a social mini-series, which is going to be really fun. We're hiring like a spokesperson of the brand.
Love.
Can't tell more. It's very,
that's very, cool.
Very awesome. Silly, very fun.
Awesome.
So want to get like all of that in order before we launch officially D2C, but we'll have a D2C outlet, which will be good.
Awesome. And amazing. You're on TikTok, Instagram.
On TikTok, on Instagram, amazing. LinkedIn. In person.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, guys, for listening. Thank you, Ray. This was an amazing, amazing episode. Feel free, please follow Hooray Girl Beer. Also, obviously, always reach out to us on onceplayingpod1@gmail.com. We're on Instagram and TikTok, too. And thanks for listening, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.